The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. We again have a new edition of Time Magazine for me to read from today. It's dated February 24, 2025. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. Time is in large block print lettering in white, superimposed upon an off-white to pale gray background, populated by four individuals. They all look young to me. There are two blonde women and two dark-haired young men. They all look young, as I said. The young men have facial hair also, and lots of hair on their heads. They have dark eyes. One of the women has blue-green eyes. One has brown eyes. Some are smiling slightly, but not a whole lot. The caption reads, "Our cancer mystery, why it's now striking us so young." And the people populating the front cover, their images anyway, are identified. Giancarlo, diagnosed with lung cancer at 18. Kelly, diagnosed with colorectal cancer at 28. Imtloss, diagnosed with colon cancer at 26. Carrie, diagnosed with ovarian cancer at 40. Beginning now with the brief. Has a full cover photograph in color of a man dressed in a dark blue suit, dark blue tie, white shirt, looking askance from the camera. He appears to be standing or walking in front of a concrete block or stone building. It is Elon Musk, and it says, "A Thousand Cuts" by Simon Schuster and Brian Bennett. Elon Musk's War on Washington. The first name is spelled E-L-O-N, last name M-U-S-K. This is the brief opener. Let's see. With reporting, let's see, we've got two reporters, Simon Schuster and Brian Bennett, with more reporting by Eric Cortalesa, Philip Elliott, Nick Popley, and Tessa Berenson-Rogers, Washington. The standoff at 1300 Pennsylvania Avenue was not much of a spectacle. On the first day of February, a handful of men working for Elon Musk had come to the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, a few blocks from the White House, demanding full access to its headquarters. The agency staff refused. No guns were drawn, no punches thrown, nobody involved the police. But in these early days of the Trump administration, perhaps no other scene revealed more clearly the forces reshaping America's government. On one side stood an institution with a 64-year history, a $35 million budget, a mission enshrined in federal law. On the other stood Musk's political wrecking crew. They identified themselves as members of the Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, a collection of temporary staffers with no charter, no website, no clear legal authority. Its power derives from Musk, the wealthiest person on the planet, who's been deputized to dismantle vast swaths of the federal bureaucracy, slashing budgets, gutting the civil service, stripping independent agencies of the ability to impede the president's objectives. USAID leadership had allowed Musk's team, a group of his young and eager followers, to spend several days inside their headquarters at the end of January. The DOGE kids, as some of the staffers called them in private, walked the halls with clipboards in their hands, examining desks and questioning managers, according to several USAID officials who described the events to Time. But as the weekend arrived, their demands, including access to sensitive facilities designed to store classified information, went too far for the agency's heads of security. The men from DOGE threatened to call the U.S. Marshals and have them clear the building. They also informed Musk about the problem. USAID is a criminal organization, Musk wrote to his 215 million followers on his social media platform X. Soon after, time for it to die. The cause of Musk's crusade remained unclear, but regardless of the reason, by the following morning, an agency that annually disperses tens of billions of dollars across the globe, fighting famine and disease and bringing clean water to millions, had mostly ceased to function. Within a week, nearly all its staff were placed on leave. Its offices around the world shut down. Every other government bureau got the message loud and clear. No single private citizen, certainly not one whose wealth and web of businesses are directly subject to the oversight of federal authorities, has wielded such power over the machinery of the U.S. government. So far, Musk appears accountable to no one but President Trump, who handed his campaign benefactor a sweeping mandate to bring the government in line with his agenda. DOGE directed all of Time's questions about its work to the White House, which declined to comment. Already, the DOGE team has taken over the U.S. Digital Service and established a beachhead within the Federal Human Resources Department, the Office of Personnel Management, OPM. The Education Department is on edge, fearing a self-decapitation mandate is in the offing. Few agencies seem safe. Musk has shown he will tolerate no opposition, no matter how justified. Days before the drama at USAID, a Treasury official refused DOGE access to the U.S. federal payment system. The official was forced to retire, and the newly appointed Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, gave DOGE the access it demanded. The administration agreed February 5 to restrict that access, at least temporarily, after a group of past and present employees sued. These are just the first ripples in a massive anti-government wave. Budgets will be hacked. Valuable programs will be eliminated. Career civil servants will be purged, replaced with political appointees whose primary qualification is apparent fealty to the president. This is the course the electorate chose, and to many, the idea of one of the world's most accomplished entrepreneurs attacking a sprawling, sclerotic federal bureaucracy with the same velocity and determination he brought to his car startup or rocket company is cause for celebration, not alarm. The federal government is so big that there are surely significant opportunities for saving and efficiency, says Robert Dorr, D-O-A-R, president of the American Enterprise Institute, a center-right think tank. The fact that the president and his team is giving this a lot of attention is a good thing. But a public backlash may be growing to Musk's mission, and far more is at stake than the size of the federal balance sheet, the headcount at agencies inside the Beltway, or the dangers of one unelected man possessing such unconstrained power. Soon Americans are going to learn where they interact with the federal government in ways they did not realize or took for granted. companies that export tech products to China may no longer have State or Commerce Department employees available to explain, for free, how to avoid violating criminal law. Farmers in the Midwest may soon find USAID-funded buyers no longer paying for sacks of flour to send to refugee camps. Around the world, millions of people who depend on the U.S. for food, medicine, and shelter are suddenly on their own. For now, millions of government workers find themselves at Musk's mercy. One described her team at the Department of Homeland Security assuming a defensive crouch as they awaited a visit from the DOGE. For an inkling of their fate, she added, her colleagues had turned to a book called Character Limit, which chronicles the way Musk took over Twitter 2 years ago and fired 80% of its staff, often with chaotic and lasting results. The similarities to his assault on the bureaucracy have been uncanny. January 28, millions of civil servants across government received an email offering them 8 months' pay in exchange for their resignation. Musk had proposed much the same deal to Twitter's employees 2 years earlier. He even used the same subject line, fork in the road. None of this came without warning. Among Musk's friends in Silicon Valley, many understood his takeover of Twitter as preparation for a greater cause. The mood is that hopefully Musk can do the same thing with the U.S. government, one told Time in November. Veterans of Trump's first administration likewise laid out their plans long before the elections, publishing a 900-page report known as Project 2025. One of its lead authors, Russell Vogt, said in a, that's V-O-U-G-H-T, said in a speech 2 years ago he wanted civil servants to be traumatically affected by the purge he envisioned. We want their funding to be shut, he said. We want to put them in trauma. On the campaign trail, Trump swore he had nothing to do with the plan. It was inappropriate that they would come out with a document like that, he told Time in November. Some things I vehemently disagreed with. But once in office, he picked Vogt to be in charge of the White House Office of Management and Budget, which now works closely with Musk to enact crucial parts of Project 2025. So far, the frenetic opening moves of the Trump presidency have tracked nearly two-thirds of its prescriptions, according to a Time analysis. Musk never hid his intentions. 2 weeks after the election, he co-wrote a piece in the Wall Street Journal that promised DOGE would help Trump hire a lean team of small government crusaders who would work to bring mass headcount reductions across the federal bureaucracy. That recruitment drive began soon after the elections, drawing from Musk's acolytes in Silicon Valley, some barely out of college, and priming them to fan out across Washington. The man Musk put in charge of staffing at DOGE was an aerospace engineer named Steve Davis, who previously led his cost-cutting efforts at Twitter. In late December, as the presidential transition unfolded inside the White House, Davis took part in a series of meetings with members of the Biden administration. The Democratic staffers noted his fixation with an obscure branch of the White House called the U.S. Digital Service. Davis wanted to know how it operated, who it reported to, and what it could access. Created in 2014, the USDS works with federal agencies to improve computer systems and databases. It houses a map of the government's technology infrastructure and has contact points for the technology officer at nearly every federal agency. That made it the perfect place to host the DOGE. If Musk wanted to wither the limbs of the federal government, the USDS provided the veins that would let the poison flow. the empowerment of USDS started on Inauguration Day. One of Trump's first executive orders renamed it the United States DOGE Service, neatly preserving the office's acronym. The order also ensured the new entity would report directly to the White House Chief of Staff. Since then, the office has set up shop inside the Departments of State and Treasury. It began accessing personnel computer systems, firing contractors, and blocking payments on their contracts. Musk also sent a team to OPM. The office holds records on 2.1 million workers, the email address for nearly every federal employee, and tracks $59 billion per year in federal health care premiums and $88 billion per year in payments to federal retirees. The mass buyout offer to government employees originated from within Musk's team at OPM, according to a source familiar with those actions. Both DOGE and the White House declined to comment. Next, the DOGE team set to starving OPM itself. Brian Bield, who recently worked as vice president of human resources at Musk's aerospace firm, told career supervisors at OPM the target was to slash 70% of its staff, a move that would hobble its health care benefits and retirement planning teams, says a current OPM official. Some senior leaders at OPM have been locked out of key databases, the official says, and political appointees have access to systems, including the Enterprise Human Resources Integration, without standard safeguard procedures designed to keep such information private. That system includes information like pay grades, length of service, social security numbers, dates of birth, and home addresses. Days after Trump took office, the White House ordered a freeze on federal spending, from foreign aid to public health programs, and everything in between. It would be lifted, the administration said, as agencies fell in line with the president's agenda, cracking down on immigration, ending diversity efforts, stopping investments that reduce the impact of fossil fuels on the environment. Facing a court's action, the White House rolled back the order. Musk's downsizing pressed ahead. Trump continued to give his blessing. Elon can't do and won't do anything without our approval, Trump told reporters in the Oval Office February 4. We will give him the approval where appropriate, he added. Where not appropriate, we won't. Some took it as a sign Trump might rein in his attack dog, but civil servants are not waiting around for that to happen. In Northern Virginia, home to tens of thousands of workers on the federal payroll and military service members, the typical town hall meeting in the town of Leesburg attracts a few dozen people. Hundreds gathered on the night Musk shut down USAID. We are hearing bizarre stories, says Representative Suhas Subramaniam, the local Democratic congressman who spoke at the event. His office has been flooded with workers describing DOGE's takeover, and he instructed his staff to log their testimony and assist whistleblowers. Much of what they witnessed is simply illegal, Subramaniam insists to Time. We are almost being tested and dared to sue or investigate. Some lawsuits have worked. The White House complied with court orders blocking its attempt to freeze trillions of dollars in federal spending. A judge's ruling February 6 delayed the deadline for the buyout offer to government employees. Unions have filed suits related to DOGE on behalf of federal workers. Even Musk's usual admirers have warned he is overreaching. The lawsuits are already flying, a February 4 Wall Street Journal editorial noted, and courts will derail Mr. Musk's project before it even gets off the ground if he isn't careful. On Capitol Hill, Musk's assault on the bureaucracy has set up a battle with Democrats that could determine the future of the government and the balance of power within it. We do not have a fourth branch of government, called Elon Musk, Maryland Democrat Jamie Raskin told a crowd outside USAID on the afternoon of February 3, while the men from DOGE tried to impose their demands inside. Raskin was right. But the agency staffers listening to him on Pennsylvania Avenue, unsure of whether they still had a job, could not tell how much power Musk had acquired and whether he would bend the other branches of government to his will. One staffer seemed especially skeptical. Yes, she told Time, the Constitution grants Congress the power of the purse, but Musk had shown his power to yank it away. There's only so much Democrats can do, she said, not wanting to give her name, lest it attract more attention from DOGE. Her official email account had been shut down, and she could no longer access her desk at the agency. Like thousands of her colleagues and millions of Americans, she was left to watch Musk's moves play out, wondering how far he would go and what, if anything, could stop him. The Brief, A Thousand Cuts, by Simon Schuster and Brian Bennett, with reporting by Eric Cortalesa, Philip Elliott, Nick Popley, and Tessa Berenson Rogers, Washington. Not abridged. Burial Ground, this is an almost half-page full-color photograph. I'll read the caption first. Members of the Congolese Red Cross and Civilian Protection deliver dozens of bodies to a cemetery in the city of Goma, February 3. The UN said that day that fighting between Congolese government forces and Rwanda-backed rebels over control of the country's mineral resources had killed at least 900 people and left over 2,800 injured. It's a bleak scene here. There's a lot of brown dirt, the grave sites, a lot of people dressed in white hazmat suits with masks and hoods and gloves, carrying body bags, presumably comprising bodies. There's a Red Cross truck in the background. It looks like not quite as long as our 18-wheelers that we see on the roadways, but a pretty large truck. It looks like it has the canvas covering on the back with the Red Cross emblazoned on both the truck and the trailer. Houses in the back, or maybe not houses, but buildings. One is red-roofed and appears to be a pale stucco color. Others appear to be stone, gray to brown to cream-colored stone. A couple more vehicles in the background. Some kids on bikes riding by the perimeter of the graveyard. And that's about it. It's the burial ground. Turning the page to the Brief News, good question. Why aren't companies held accountable for data breaches, by Alana Samuels? It is becoming increasingly common to receive an email or phone call informing you your personal information was stolen in a data breach. Last year, there were 3,158 data breaches, up 70% from 2021, which resulted in an all-time high of nearly 1.7 billion notices going out to potentially affected individuals, according to a report released January 28 by Identity Theft Resource Center, ITRC. Each data breach makes additional ones more likely because the personal information hackers steal can be used to get into other companies' systems. That is one likely reason for the spike in data breaches. But watchdogs point out another reason. There are relatively easy things companies can do to protect information, and many companies are not doing them. These steps include using multi-factor authentication, a security method that requires users to provide more than one form of authentication to access an account. Companies should also mandate employees change their passwords frequently and ensure vendors and other companies they work with have appropriate measures in place. There were 6 mega breaches in 2024, in which at least 100 million victims were affected, according to ITRC. 4 of those breaches could have been prevented if the organizations had used multi-factor authentication, the organization says. One of the companies involved in a mega breach, Change Healthcare, a subsidiary of United Health, admitted as much in a May 2024 congressional hearing. But many of the companies compromised get off with a slap on the wrist from regulators, if that. Though public companies and others regulated by the federal government face stricter financial penalties for data breaches, only about 7% of all breaches come from publicly traded companies, according to ITRC. There's no national law covering what other organizations should do if they've been compromised. We do not have an actual privacy law or any uniform minimum standards, says James Lee, president of ITRC. If we did, we could track compliance. When a company learns its customers' data have been compromised, it may not even have to inform them of the problem. State laws determine what a company needs to do, and in most states, Lee says, the compromised company can decide whether there is the risk of harm to individuals. If it determines there's no risk, they do not have to send out notices. Even if they do, in many states, the company determines what those notices say. It can decline to tell customers how the information was compromised or which personal information was stolen. Of course, sending out a notice to customers does not help them much. They can freeze their credit or closely monitor their accounts, but they won't get refunded money because their information was compromised. For that, they'd have to sue or have someone do it on their behalf. But it's extremely difficult to successfully sue a company for financial relief after a data breach, Lee says. Plaintiffs have to prove they've been harmed by the incursion. With so many different attacks, it's almost impossible to know which one caused a customer's problems. As a result, few companies can be held financially accountable for data breaches. Florida even passed a law that says companies cannot be sued at all for data breaches if they demonstrate they have implemented certain security procedures. It is a little bit of a cycle where prior breaches feed into future breaches, says Aaron Cookstra, a director with the threat intel team at Aon Cyber Solutions. But we do not see companies necessarily taking the measures that they need to avoid that potentially becoming an issue down the line for them. Lee of the ITRC is holding out for a national privacy law that would set minimum standards for what cybersecurity safeguards companies need to have in place and what they have to do when their data's been compromised. It's hard to establish those standards because companies need to constantly change their security procedures to keep information safe. But even saying companies have to do something to protect customers' information, Lee says, would be a big step in the right direction. The Bulletin, how Trump's tariffs could hike prices in the U.S., and again by Alana Samuels. Inflation-weary Americans chose Donald J. Trump for president, in part because they were sick of seeing prices continue to rise. Now, experts say prices for homes, cars, fuel, and food may end up jumping again, this time because of the tariffs Trump announced February 1 on Mexico, Canada, and China. February 3, both Mexico and Canada struck deals to delay their tariffs by 30 days. But a 10% tariff on Chinese imports went into effect February 4. Here are some of the products that could be most affected. Autos. Car parts move across borders many times during manufacturing, which means tariffs will add up, says Michael Hicks, a professor at Ball State University in Indiana. He estimates that this set of tariffs could increase the price of a sedan by around $2,000. The cost of a big SUV would go up even more because it has so many different electronic components, he says. Housing. Materials for home building are getting more expensive, and the tariffs will not help. The National Association of Home Builders says Canada and Mexico supply 70% of the softwood lumber and gypsum, an ingredient in drywall, used in residential construction. The 25% tariff on softwood lumber comes on top of a 14.5% tariff in place since August. Consumers may end up paying in the form of higher home prices, which are already up about 40% since 2020. And cheap stuff online. Many economists are not thinking as much about the 10% tariffs on China because those tariffs are relatively small compared with the ones announced on the U.S.'s North American counterparts. But they're overlooking the end of something called the de minimis provision, which exempts companies from tariffs if the goods in a shipment are worth less than $800. The latest executive orders on tariffs suspended the de minimis provision, a move likely to affect online retailers like Shine, Temu, and even Amazon. They also mean stuff you're buying on the internet that comes directly from China, like cheap clothes and electronics, is likely to become a little more expensive soon. Here's the milestones page. We have five of the thumbnail sketches and one longer column, which I will read first. One, W-O-N. Album of the Year, Beyoncé's Moment, finally, by Taylor Crumpton, who's a music, culture, and politics writer. There is a photo here. Oh, I'd say it's about an eighth of a page in color. The buxom Beyoncé, with her long blonde hair, is standing at a microphone, holding something, perhaps an award, we don't know quite yet. She is wearing what looks like a gold lamé, or at least it's a sparkly golden gown, with narrow straps, a dipped bodice, a tight skirt. I don't know how long it is. It's cut off at about her knees. The photo is, and it has some white figures in the fabric of the gown. She's also wearing, oh goodness, 3/4 length gloves, I would say. She's smiling anyway. Album of the Year, Beyoncé's Moment, finally, by Taylor Crumpton. When Beyoncé won the Album of the Year award for Cowboy Carter at the Grammy Awards February 2, she became the first black woman to win the award this century, and the fourth ever. All I can say is finally, and what a win it was. It is one thing to win the night's most prestigious award. It is another to win for an album that weaves the singer's personal story of growing up as a black girl in Texas with the expansive history of black country music. From honoring Linda Martell, country music's first black woman superstar, to helping propel the careers of modern-day black country singers, to paying homage to the entertainers who toured the Chitlin' Circuit. If you don't know about the Chitlin' Circuit, read about B.B. King. Beyoncé's win, which occurred on the second day of Black History Month, was a welcome reprieve for many Black Americans mourning the political reality of this moment, as well as rollbacks of diversity efforts in the federal government and corporate America. For a country girl from Houston to win the Recording Academy's biggest honor, that's an interesting contradiction, a country girl from Houston. Well, anyway, biggest honor is barrier-breaking because it allows us to be fully recognized, even in the face of the limits placed upon us then and now. Country music has always been a place for anti-black and anti-woman sentiments to flourish and prosper. Indeed, when the first Cowboy Carter singles, Texas Hold'em and 16 Carriages, were released, some country radio stations refused to play them, believing Beyoncé is not country. It is unrealistic to think one album has the power to undo decades-long racial segregation. But if radio programmers have said the industry is ready for a black woman star, black women country stars are few and far between. While Cowboy Carter will not change that, what it did show us is that we will never be invisible, we will never be forgotten or erased, and in the event we are overlooked in this lifetime, there will always be another generation to uplift us again. We will speak the names that are lost to time and those that live within us. We're always here. We'll always have hope. In her acceptance speech, Beyoncé said, "It's been many, many years." Indeed, it did feel like a brief exhale, a way to acknowledge just how long this moment took to arrive. After Linda Martell was blacklisted from the country music industry, she took on a mix of jobs to support her children, education aide, bus driver. She did whatever she had to do. Now at the age of 83, she is receiving her due. The onus is always on us to hold the door open for the next black woman to arrive, because if not us, then who? That was written in the first-person voice by Taylor Crumpton, and it's about Beyoncé, who in this photo looks golden. Okay, starting with the thumbnail sketches under the milestones heading, increased the price of a serving of eggs at Waffle House after the Georgia-based fast food chain announced a temporary 50-cent surcharge February 4. The company attributed the price bump to the nationwide rise in cost of eggs because of bird flu. Appointed Syria's transitional president, Ahmed al-Shara, by armed factions, January 29, following the ousting of former President Bashar Assad late last year. Proposed U.S. ownership of the Gaza Strip, emptied of Palestinians and rebuilt as the Riviera of the Middle East, by President Donald Trump. At a February 4 news conference, the suggestion drew widespread condemnation. Crashed a medevac jet over residential blocks and businesses in the neighborhood of Northeast Philadelphia, January 31, killing 7 people and injuring 24. Died singer and actor Marianne Faithfull, who released her hit single As Tears Go By at the age of 16 and was known as a Rolling Stones muse, January 30 at the age of 78. Here's the last page of the magazine. Don't worry, we haven't read everything in between the covers yet. This is 8 questions. Today it's written by Eliana Doctorman, and it's about Mindy Kaling, K-A-L-I-N-G, the writer, producer, and showrunner, on the status of Legally Blonde 3, Cooking with Meghan Markle, and her new Netflix comedy, Running Point. Let's see if there are 8 questions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, starting with the question in the center. The family in Running Point has shades of Succession. Was that show on your mind? Answer, I mean, I love Succession, but the great news about the Buss, B-U-S-S, family, if you read Jeannie's book, Laker Girl, or read any stories about the Buss family, is that they really are a famously dysfunctional, extremely wealthy Los Angeles family. What's the status, this is question and answer format, what's the status of Legally Blonde 3, which you co-wrote? Answer, I am so glad you asked. I do not have any power here. It's MGM, Amazon, Hello Sunshine. But Dan Gore and I wrote a draft we really like. We hope it sees the light of day. Also, Jennifer Coolidge, since the time we started this project, has had this renaissance with White Lotus. If you put Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer in a movie right now, I don't know a single person who would not run to the theaters. Next, it's going to be the guy who plays Warner, who blows up. My dream is that he is cast in Succession creator Jesse Armstrong's next show. Question, how did you come to appear on Meghan Markle's new show? Answer, I was on maternity leave, and Meghan texted me she was doing a show where she was going to cook for her friends. I wanted to get taken care of in that moment in my life, and I left with a basket of fresh produce and homemade jam and hot sauce because she knew I loved hot sauce. She's a very generous woman who knew I needed a break. Did you pick up any hosting tips? Answer, spoiler alert, I did. The theme was throwing a party for children. For kids' parties, I usually just go to the party supply store and get paper things, which Meghan doesn't judge. But it was fun to learn simple ways to do a homemade kids' party. I think a misconception about Meghan is that she's in any way fussy or has expectations of fanciness. She really is a down-to-earth person who knows a lot of fun tricks to make entertaining and cooking easier. Question, do you think you'll ever star in one of your shows again? Answer, I always feel flattered when people remember I'm a performer since it's been such a long time. Every show we've done, I've been tempted. Never Have I Ever was literally about an Indian American family living in Southern California. If I cannot cast myself in that, right now I have 3 kids under the age of 7, but I miss it. I would like to return to screen in the next couple years. Question, the new series out February 27 is about a family running an NBA team, with Kate Hudson playing a version of real-life Lakers president Jeannie Buss. Where did that idea come from? Answer, it was actually Jeannie who reached out because she liked the Mindy Project and The Office. So many people have written about her or made shows where she's a tertiary character. She was like, I run this. I want to be a producer on a show about my own life. Question, did Buss put any guardrails on her life story? Answer, she is so open. We consult her for real-life details all the time. There have been very specific players or very specific people in her personal life where she'll say, maybe we won't touch upon that. But she says that far less than any other person I've known. She gave us carte blanche on her life because she wanted it to be funny. She knew the realer it gets, the funnier it will be. Question, did you get to riff on Kate Hudson's persona as a rom-com queen? Answer, Kate Hudson and other rom-com stars like Meg Ryan, Tom Hanks, Sandra Bullock are the type of people who can say tough things, and you do not dislike them for saying it. We're stealing that for the show because she is a tough employer. Also, Kate is so iconically L.A. She's from her own Hollywood dynasty. She's known Jeannie since she was a kid. She's been going to Lakers games since she was little. The Brief Health. 5 Ways to Stand Up for Yourself at Doctor's Visits by Angela Haupt. Steph Fowler can tick off a long list of conditions that doctors initially chalked up to mental health. endometriosis, a stomach infection, insomnia, and more. She was sent for a full neuropsychiatric evaluation before her doctors eventually diagnosed her with long COVID. Figuring out what was really going on filled Fowler with a combination of relief that somebody knows I am not making it up and I can trust myself, and the grief of knowing it could have been different. After the ordeal, Fowler shifted her therapy practice in Chicago to support clients with chronic and misunderstood illnesses, helping them advocate for themselves when dealing with doctors who dismiss their symptoms as anxiety. It's been alarming to discover how common this is, she says. There are a variety of reasons why that's so, says Dr. Robert G., G-E-E, or Gee, I'm not sure which, a behavioral sciences professor at Ross University School of Medicine. Anxiety symptoms overlap with those of other medical issues, which makes it easy for both patients and clinicians to mistake a physical condition for one related to mental health. And if a patient has a history of anxiety, their provider might assume the symptoms are a recurrence rather than a sign of something new. The consequences of a misdiagnosis can be significant. Patients may suffer longer without proper treatment, which can make their health worse, G says. Ironically, being told it's just anxiety can make them even more anxious, since they have to worry their concerns are not being taken seriously. This loss of trust can dissuade people from seeking further care, he adds. We asked experts what to do if a doctor does not take your symptoms seriously and instead dismisses them as anxiety. 1. Bring someone to appointments with you. It is helpful to have someone with you, Fowler says, especially if you tend to get nervous or have a lot of symptoms to remember. A friend can help jog your memory, but also give outside validation and input about what they have seen happening, she says. Some research suggests physicians sometimes treat female patients differently than they do males. Anecdotally, Fowler has found that if you bring a man to your appointment, they might listen more. 2. Track your symptoms. Before talking to your doctor, spend time planning the best way to paint a vivid, accurate description of your symptoms, G suggests. Apps that digitally track symptoms like mood and migraines are your friends here. It can really help make your case and see trends over time, Fowler says. 3. Encourage your providers to collaborate. Some providers practice collaborative care, which means a patient's specialists work together. That kind of integration can help ensure physical symptoms are not mistaken for mental health ones, says Dr. Monica Roots, a child and adolescent psychiatrist. If you're not able to go to a collaborative care practice, you can still ask your different doctors to communicate with one another. For example, Roots says, you can ask your primary care doctor, could you talk to the psychiatrist I'm also seeing? 4. Ask specific questions. Help your doctor feel like you're part of the team, G says. He suggests phrasing a request for additional workups like this. Could we do a few extra tests just to rule things out? It would really help to put my mind at ease. If your doctor continues to brush off your symptoms as being all in your head, Fowler recommends responding like this. If it's not anxiety, what else could it be? And how are you ruling this out? If your doctor still isn't willing to run tests, ask specifically how your case does not qualify. 5. Appeal to your doctor's human side. Fowler has found it can be helpful to ask, if you had a loved one with these symptoms, what would your next steps be? The question often spurs doctors to consider the situation with genuine patients and care. That way, it's not just the patient they're seeing at 12:35 before their lunch break, she says. If it's somebody they care about, they're more likely to be engaged. And this article will probably be abridged for time constraints. It's the brief news, Tech, Deep Seeks Hidden Warning for AI Safety by Billy Perigo. The release of DeepSeek R1 stunned Wall Street and Silicon Valley in January, spooking investors and impressing tech leaders. But amid all the talk, many overlooked a critical detail about the way the new Chinese artificial intelligence model functions, a nuance that has researchers worried about humanity's ability to control sophisticated new AI systems. It's all down to an innovation in how DeepSeek, that's one word, R1, was trained, one that led to surprising behaviors in an early version of the model, which researchers described in the technical documentation accompanying its release. During testing, researchers noticed the model would spontaneously switch between English and Chinese while it was solving problems. When they forced it to stick to one language, thus making it easier for users to follow along, they found the system's ability to solve the same problems would diminish. That finding rang alarm bells for some AI safety researchers. Currently, the most capable AI systems think in human-legible languages, writing out their reasoning before coming to a conclusion. That has been a boon for safety teams, whose most effective guardrails involve monitoring models' so-called chains of thought for signs of dangerous behaviors. But DeepSeek's results raise the possibility of a decoupling on the horizon, one where new AI capabilities might be gained from freeing models of the constraints of human language altogether. To be sure, DeepSeek's language switching is not by itself cause for alarm. Instead, what worries researchers is the new innovation that caused it. The DeepSeek paper describes a novel training method whereby the model was rewarded purely for getting correct answers, regardless of how comprehensible its thinking process was to humans. The worry is that this incentive-based approach could eventually lead AI systems to develop completely inscrutable ways of reasoning, maybe even creating their own non-human languages, if doing so proves to be more effective. Were the AI industry to proceed in that direction, seeking more powerful systems by giving up on legibility, it would take away what was looking like it could have been an easy win for AI safety, says Sam Bowman, the leader of a research department at AI company Anthropic, focused on aligning AI to human preferences. We would be forfeiting an ability that we might otherwise have had to help keep an eye on them. An AI creating its own alien tongue is not as outlandish as it may sound. Last December, Meta researchers set out to test the hypothesis that human language was not the optimal format for carrying out reasoning, and that large language models, or LLMs, the AI systems, like those that underpin OpenAI's ChatGPT and DeepSeek's R1, might be able to reason more efficiently and accurately if they were unhobbled by that linguistic constraint. The Meta researchers went on to design a model that, instead of carrying out its reasoning in words, did so using a series of numbers that represented the most recent patterns inside its neural network, essentially its internal reasoning engine. This model, they discovered, began to generate what they called continuous thoughts, essentially numbers encoding multiple potential reasoning paths simultaneously. The numbers were completely opaque and inscrutable to human eyes, but this strategy, they found, created emergent, advanced reasoning patterns in the model. Those patterns led to higher scores on some logical reasoning tasks compared with models that reasoned using human language. The meta research project was very different from DeepSeek's. Its findings dovetailed with the Chinese research in one crucial way. Both DeepSeek and Meta showed human legibility imposes a tax on the performance of AI systems, according to Jeremy Harris, CEO of Gladstone AI, which advises the U.S. government on AI safety. Take that process to its logical conclusion, Harris says, and there's no reason an AI's thought process should be legible to humans at all. This possibility has some safety experts concerned. It seems like the writing's on the wall that there is this other avenue available for AI research where you just optimize for the best reasoning you can get, says Bowman, the Anthropic safety team leader. I expect people will scale this work up, and the risk is we wind up with models where we're not able to say with confidence that we know what they are trying to do, what their values are, or how they would make hard decisions when we set them up as agents. For their part, the meta researchers argued their research need not result in humans being relegated to the sidelines. It would be ideal for LLMs to have the freedom to reason without any language constraints and then translate their findings into language only when necessary, they wrote in their paper. Meta did not respond to a request for comment on the suggestion that the research could lead in a dangerous direction. While having AI explain itself in human terms is not perfect, many researchers think it's better than the alternative, letting AI develop its own mysterious internal language that we cannot understand. If we do not pursue this path, I think we will be in a much better position for safety, Bowman says. If we do, we will have taken away what right now seems like our best point of leverage on some very scary open problems in alignment that we have not yet solved. That article was slightly abridged. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.